In 2 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, as Paul was reflecting on the contribution that he was in the process of gathering to take to the brethren in Jerusalem, was thinking about the poverty of the Macedonians who had given so liberally and so abundantly out of their poverty. He was contemplating the gesture of Gentiles contributing financially, materially to the aid of their Jewish brethren. As he was thinking about the opportunity that God had made available, that God had blessed these people with so they in turn could contribute and be a blessing to others, he says at the end of 2 Corinthians chapter 9, the last verse, "Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift." And I must say, this evening, I want to echo those sentiments of Paul. The outpouring of generosity this morning, just by mentioning the need of Brother John Haynes and his family in the Dayton area, has just resulted in an unbelievable outpouring of generosity. I am extremely humbled and proud to be associated with such generous people as here at Embry Hills. And it is just such a tremendous encouragement to me. And if it is to me, I can't imagine what it'll be to the Haynes family when they see this outpouring of love from the congregation here, when they understand that people here understand that they have been blessed by God. And it is a grace, it is a gift, in verse 15, to be able to participate in this way with those who are legitimately in need. So I thank you. You've encouraged me just as the messenger boy. And I am so deeply grateful that you are of the character that you are of. And I know the Haynes family will be deeply appreciative of the offering on their behalf. Well, we're going to begin the new year on the first day of the year by thinking a little bit about the theme of the year that the elders have set before us, and Marty had some things to say about at the conclusion of our service this morning. The idea that we want to develop in various ways through the year is building godly, and that's the key term as the elders have laid this out, building godly marriages and families. As we contemplate what we're being called to do in building godly marriages and then on top of that, godly families, I'll say we have a bewildering array of concepts that we need to try somehow to work our way through. And particularly, I'll be speaking at this particular moment of those perhaps not yet married. And yet, for those of us who are, there are things that we need to evaluate. There are things that we need to consider as we try to understand the nature of the relationship that we sustain with our husbands and wives. And you see various thoughts and ideas that are coming onto the screen one by one here. And I didn't try to be exhaustive in this, but I came up with just 21 different notions and ideas and concepts that we might be confronted with when we think about establishing or maintaining particularly a marital relationship, or at least preparing to establish a marital relationship. Sometimes we joke about the difficulty that that each have in understanding members of the opposite sex. And I'll just say for the record, I'm glad I'm already married, and I married a person of quality. I can say that without hesitation. You know, it's just difficult, I think, to undertake this process in our society of finding someone that we can commit ourselves to for life and according to the principles of God. And as we think about some of these concepts that we have represented by the words on the screen, I'll just ask you to take a look at some of those activities or attitudes, as the case may be, and ask you to think about on your own, how do you take all of these different concepts regarding relationships and blend them into a solid spiritual philosophy on understanding the opposite sex or to evaluate someone that you might be considering marrying or evaluating the one that you're married to and the nature of that relationship. How do you look at all of these different ideas from a godly perspective? Because that is the challenge. The challenge that we have is to sift through society's definitions of these things, society's elevation of some of these things. And I'll tell you, we just get this thing turned completely upside down. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But society just totally mixes up the priorities regarding some of these things. But how do you come to the idea of true relationship and godly relationship? And how do you come to evaluate, prioritize, understand clearly some of the concepts that we have represented here? I think sometimes, as we have listed here, infatuation really passes for love. And I don't know that we even know how we use the word love when we use it half the time. What do we mean when we say, I love a good hamburger, and I love my wife, or I love my husband? What are we placing into those respective words as we speak about food or our pet or a sport, and then we might refer to our mate? I think oftentimes we misunderstand infatuation for love. And infatuation might involve some of these other things like attractiveness, physical attractiveness, and all of the head-swimming feelings that come along with the smell of the cologne or the perfume or the song that's playing while we're on a date. And I got a lot to say about that over the course of time. But the whole notion of attractiveness physically, as that concept is elevated in the Western world, lends itself to building up the idea of infatuation. Romance, again, some of those features we've just mentioned, but perhaps focusing specifically on the emotional elements that we might experience in a relationship with someone else. What do we mean when we say we're in love? We're in love. What does society mean by that? What does our culture mean by that? How do you define being in love? Especially as we try to think of these things from a godly point of view. And then just trying to identify something accurately in a godly way, such as friendship. How do you view that idea? So often it's friendships that end up turning into illicit relationships or business acquaintances. And do we know even how to be friends with someone of the opposite sex, perhaps? Do we know how to be friends, and what kind of concepts, godly concepts, would adhere in friendship as opposed to marriage? Can we differentiate that from infatuation? Can we separate our feelings from our reason and thus perhaps see a dangerous path that we're heading down? What does the word commitment mean to us? Doesn't apparently mean much to the world. We can get up in front of not only the preacher or the judge, we get up in front of our acquaintances and family members and friends and verbally make these vows and say, I do. Until death do us part, and forsaking all others. And so often those kinds of committed words go by the wayside. What is a godly view of some of these concepts that society just throws at us and tries to enhance in all of the wrong ways? And as we think about all of those concepts, we might ask ourselves, what am I looking for in a marital relationship? What is it of those concepts, or maybe some others we could think of? What is it? Am I clear on that if I'm not yet married? Am I clear on what it is that I'm really looking for in a marital partner? And have I worked at, am I consciously working at viewing all of these different conflicting ideas that culture and society would throw in our path? Am I looking to define those things through the eyes of godliness, through the concepts that God would reveal in His Word? Well, the influence of our culture is extremely powerful, in part because our culture is stressing the emotion, stressing the feeling side of relationships, and incorporating all kinds of marketing techniques to get us to think wrongly about some of these concepts that, if acted on, will establish a marriage on a shaky foundation. Are we clear regarding the influence of our culture and the mechanisms that our culture might use to skew a godly view of the dynamics of relationships? Well, we hear a lot from our culture that love is a feeling. It might not be put that way, but we hear it in one form or another. We use the term, as we mentioned on the first screen, falling in love. Oh, well, we just met each other and fell in love. As if it's some force, you know, outside of us that sort of forces its way in and takes control of us and throws two people together, and it all comes down to a feeling. The idea of falling in love at first sight. I have no doubt that there are people who meet each other for the first time and fall in love at first sight, end up marrying, and have a happy and a committed relationship. I don't doubt that that happens. But is the kind of love that serves as the bedrock of a marital relationship the kind of love that happens at first sight? Or is it something else that happens at first sight? And then, if it's going to be the foundation of a relationship, must develop over the course of time. In Judges chapter 14, verses 1 through 3, I suppose there's a fairly good example of this sort of falling in love idea, which I think generally tends to speak in a very selfish way. And we might ask ourselves, you know, what is it that I'm looking for in a marital partner, and how much of that is self-directed, self-motivated, that I'm looking to satisfy certain of my own internal longings or needs. But this idea that you fall in love or fall out of love, and that's the problem with falling in love, and the way that we use the terminology is you can fall out of it, and in any case, you feel like you're free from responsibility. Oh, well, it just happened. We just fell in love, and, well, it just happened. We just fell out of love. And this sort of very superficial, emotional, reactive kind of a feeling you have about someone certainly isn't the basis for a lasting relationship. Judges 14, beginning in verse 1, "Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, 'I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore,'" I don't know how this translates in English. It sounds like a caveman in English. "Get her for me as a wife. Me want woman. Get her for me as wife." And I don't know how high Samson's concept was above that in terms of a relationship. "Then his father and mother said to him, 'Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?' And Samson said to his father, 'Get her for me, for she pleases me well.'" I don't know what was behind Samson's attraction to the woman of Timnah, but it certainly appears to be extremely selfish, self-gratifying, self-motivated. It does not appear to be any kind of decision entered into with reason and balance and circumspection. And Samson's father and mother are trying to reason with him. And boy, is this difficult, isn't it? When we've fallen in love, whatever that means, and the emotions are at a fever pitch and the hormones are bouncing all over the place and we're awash in this romantic feeling, And everybody else around us is going, this is going to be a disaster. And they might try to sit down and talk to us and say, this is going to be a disaster. And you know, in my experience, I may be a poor communicator, and that's entirely possible, but I just haven't had much experience, much success in trying to convince someone who is totally emotionally involved with the wrong person, that they're involved with the wrong person. And so it can happen when we're so emotionally wrapped up in things that reason is put aside, sensibility is put aside, the good judgment of other people is put aside, and we pursue this course, I want woman. Get her for me. And of course, this was a disaster for Samson. In 2 Samuel chapter 13, we have even probably a more graphic illustration of selfish emotional foundations for a relationship. This is Amnon and Tamar. But you may remember Amnon falls madly in love. Falls madly in love, whatever we mean by that. Overwhelmed by his passions and his feelings for his own half-sister, Tamar. And he schemes a way to get her alone privately with him. And let's see, chapter 13, verse 1, after this, it was so that Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Now, again, what's the nature of the love? Even the Bible uses the term love, but of what nature and quality was it? Verse 4, why are you the king's son, Amnon's friend says to him, becoming thinner day by day. You ever been there? Couldn't eat, couldn't sleep, couldn't focus, couldn't study, couldn't do anything. Because I'm in love. Totally overwhelmed. Got to have it. Will you not tell me? And Amnon said to him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Well, he does manage to scheme to get Tamar to himself, and then he takes full advantage of her. And you know the verse well. Verse 15, then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, arise and be gone. And the story continues to a horrendous conclusion, eventually. Here's the notion that is so at the root of our culture's view of relationships. Self-fulfilling. Considering what I want, what I think in the moment is going to make me happy, and it's about that deep, and it's heading us toward a disastrous and a precipitous cliff, and yet headlong we run right over that cliff, motivated by passion, motivated by our feelings, motivated by physical gratification. These things are not the foundation of relationship, and yet in our culture they stand at the heart of the common concepts of romance and interest in the opposite sex. Well, this whole notion of love is a feeling, and I fall into love and I fall out of love, at the end, what that basically says is love is beyond our control if it's only a feeling. It just happens, or it doesn't just happen. And if it doesn't just happen, well, what can I do about it? And so the middle-aged couple, married 20, 25 years, are now heading for divorce court, and when questioned about what's happened, the man may say, well, you know, we just fell out of love. It just happened. And then we try to pretend like we're just innocent bystanders in the whole thing. We have no responsibility whatsoever. Or you say to the adulterer, what happened? Your wife is lovely and godly and beautiful and has been loyal to you and bore and raised your children. What happened between you and your secretary? Couldn't help it. It just happened. It was just one of those things. And when we go down the road of relationships being based on feelings and love being just something you fall into or fall out of, what it does essentially is it releases us from responsibility. for not being honorable, not being true, not being faithful, not loving in the way that God would have us to love. And this kind of romantic compatibility is said to lie at the heart of relationships. You get this sort of thing in, you know, trial marriage. Well, how can you know if you're compatible if you don't sleep together first? If we don't cohabit, if we don't take up a sexual relationship before we marry, well, how are we going to know if we're compatible? And again, we just reduce relationships down to the most animalistic, bare level, based on physical considerations, based on the emotions that come with it. We focus on dating. I'll try to stay off my soapbox on this, but what is dating? But usually a self-indulgent act jointly shared. A self-indulgent act jointly shared. Don't you think that describes much of dating life? What do we do when we date? Well, we go to a movie. Why? Because I want to see the movie. We go out to eat. Why? Because I like to go out and eat. We go to an amusement park. Why? Because I like to ride roller coasters. Dating so often is an artificial environment that we've created out of activities that we just that gratify ourselves. We just do it with somebody else. When my mother was in a nursing home receiving some therapy after surgery a couple of years ago, two young couples from the Mountain View congregation in Cumming came to visit her in the nursing home. Do you think that's the norm in dating? I was completely impressed that these young people had enough forethought and spiritual consideration to when they went out together, they went to see someone in the nursing home. Now, at the beginning of the lesson, I asked you to look at all those words we had on the screen and then ask yourself, what is your concept of those things? Would that be your concept of dating? To incorporate spiritual ideas and concepts into a relationship that you may be building with someone? Or is it, perhaps, most of the time, self-indulgent actions jointly shared? Well, again, much of our Western culture's focus in relationships is self-based. How does this person make me feel? Does this person satisfy my needs? Do I get approval or esteem from others because of who I'm seen with? The pendulum culturally has swung a long way from arranged marriages, which all of us, we adults, you know, who have children, joke about what a great idea that seems to be. I only think we're half joking about that, aren't we? Because what do? We leave these kinds of crucial decisions in the hands of very young people, oftentimes, who are inexperienced in true godly concepts of relationship and who are confused by all of the different cultural elements that we had on the screen a little bit ago. They're awash in very often, sensual influences by the music and the movies and the television, the culture of the day, artificial standards that have little bearing on the realities of true Christian living. And we just sort of think that, you know, they're going to find their way through this. Well, they'll just have to find their way through it all. And I'll tell you, it's a tough job in our day and time. It was probably tough when Melanie and I were searching. But is it not tougher today? Am I just sort of being egocentric in my view here? Is it not extremely difficult for young people today to work their way through this maze of cultural misinformation and excitement of the physical passions that comes at every turn, and then to try to figure out in all of this maze, what should I be looking for? What constitutes the foundation of a lifelong committed relationship? Well, I'd like for us to turn in the remainder of the lesson, that's the introduction, to three biblical principles of love that I want to share with you just in the remainder of the lesson tonight. Some of these things we'll be building on in the future. We'll be adding to some of these ideas. But just for the duration of the lesson tonight, let me suggest these three ideas to us. Number one, let me suggest, this may appear to be really peculiar on first view. Marital love is not vastly different than love in other relationships. That is, marital love is not some alien form of love that you don't see anywhere else but in a marriage. Now, I grant that marriage is unique in that there are the added elements of physical intimacy. There's the added facet of marriage being a lifelong commitment. I understand marriage is unique. However, I do believe that we find in the Scriptures that the kind of love and the kind of responsibility that underlies marriage is the kind of love and responsibility that we see in other elements of our lives, and we're supposed to manifest in other elements of our lives. Let's see if we can illustrate that with some New Testament passages. Number one, turn to John chapter 15. Page 727 in the Pew Bible, John 15. And I suspect throughout the year as we preach on these things from time to time, we're going to be thinking about this concept a lot. What the New Testament particularly says about love, and then how that applies in a marital relationship. Here's an example. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. There is not a greater example of love, Jesus says, than this. And what is he describing here in this illustration of love? Number one, he's describing that true love is selfless. That is, the greatest expression of selflessness is giving up your very life. What else can you give up that's greater than that? To empty yourself of yourself, to sacrifice, again, so many of you have, and I think given sacrificially even, this morning with the in reference to the plea that was made. But Jesus is talking about giving our life, and he says for our friends. It's a rare thing to see someone give up a life for someone else. And yet, as Jesus says, greater love has no man than this, to lay down his life for his friends. What does that say about the person I'm married to? If the greatest expression of love in friendship is the ultimate act of self-sacrifice, what do you think the greatest expression of love would be in a marriage? Don't you think it would approach something like selflessness? Being willing to sacrifice for my mate? If it is true in friendship, is it not much more true in a marriage? And yet, how often do we begin these relationships in a very selfish way? Considering what this person does for me, how this person makes me feel, how much enjoyment I get from being with this person. Rather than the reverse and to say, what can I give of myself to make this person I care about a better person? Again, so much of our early times of relationship as formulated by our culture are self-driven. And yet Jesus is over and over and over trying to get us outside of ourselves in a statement like this. Greater love has no man than this. Then a man lay down his life for his wife, her husband, their children. Can we not apply this concept to our marriages and come away with a higher and a more godly view of those marriages? Turn back to Matthew chapter 5. Jesus, in this portion of the Sermon on the Mount, is speaking of seeking the best interest of others, even our enemies, even when we have been abused by our enemies. Yet Jesus says in verse 44, "But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." Now, brethren, here's the point. If that is one of the greatest demonstrations of love, because he equates it a little bit further down with the love the Father has, if this is one of the greatest demonstrations of love and it is being directed toward our enemies, those people who do us harm, can we not with value apply that same principle to our husbands and our wives who admittedly love us? Or maybe they don't. What then? What if my wife has become my enemy? My husband has become my enemy. And I don't mean necessarily seeking to do me physical harm, but suppose they've lost their interest in me. And I don't see in them a self-sacrificing attitude. Is Jesus counseling, do unto others as they do unto you? If I'm not receiving from my husband or my wife what I deserve, I think, how should I treat them in return? Why not treat them according to Matthew 5:44? Love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who spitefully use you. Seek the best interest of that person, irrespective of what is being offered in return. Romans chapter 12 and verse 18, that's page 765 in the Pew Bible. Romans chapter 12, verse 18. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. You know, it's sad, but sometimes that's what a marriage becomes. It may be that my mate does not have my best interest at heart. What am I to do? How am I to love? Is it grounds to simply walk away? Well, they've fallen out of love with me, therefore I've fallen out of love with them, therefore there's no need in continuing this? Or might the challenge in a given marriage be overcoming evil with good? Praying and serving and doing for others that may not be treating me as I might wish to be so treated. Again, in Romans chapter 12, back in verse 9, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. What about that one verse in our relationships? You ever said to your wife, or your husband as the case may be, I'm so glad we're not in that dating stuff anymore. Especially when you see somebody else going through it. And so often what you see is these little games that boyfriends and girlfriends play with one another, trying to make the other one jealous, keeping them on a roller coaster of showing them a lot of attention and then acting like they don't care. All the while trying somehow to manipulate them into showing them interest and affection, keep them off guard, keep them off balance. I'm so glad I don't have to do that anymore. What misery that was. You never knew where the other one stood. You never knew why they were saying what they were saying, doing what they were doing. And that's when we start scratching our heads, wondering about the opposite sex. What did they do that for? Let love be without hypocrisy. Can't you apply that to relationships? Romantic, intimate relationships, marital relationships? Let love be sincere. Let it be honest. Let it show genuine character, not manipulative, selfish attempts to get what you want out of someone by mistreating them, I may say. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. In being attracted to someone else? In the way that you speak to your husband or your wife? Abhor what is evil. And cling to what is good. In 1 John chapter 3, verses 16 through 19, that's page 820, pew Bible. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16 and following. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren, but whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. By this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. Are we intent on our love for our mate bearing fruit? It's not enough just to verbalize something and then let that stand sort of as my major contribution to the relationship. Is our love bearing fruit? And again, the example points back to God. Jesus laying down his life for us. Let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. That doesn't mean we don't have to say the verbal things. What it means is we need to back up the verbal things with actions that match. That we're actually being the loving person, not just patting our wife on the back and say, "Yeah, dear, I love you," every once in a while, but living it, doing it, acting it out, that kind of love bearing fruit. One other example I'll turn to is one you've probably been waiting for. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, which I acknowledge and in fact preach a lesson along this line. This passage is speaking not specifically or contextually of romantic love. But do you not hear this quoted all the time relative to romantic relationships or marital relationships? 1 Corinthians 13 is talking about the brethren in Corinth getting along with each other. But this actually proves the point I'm trying to make here, and that is love, marital love, is not some alien thing. It's like, okay, well, all the rules of friendship and all the rules of being on the team and all the rules of being a citizen and all the rules of, you know, how to treat your brethren, all those rules are over here, but all the rules are different when it comes to your marriage. That's a whole different set of rules over here. No, it's not. What God is trying to do within us is develop godliness and get us to act and speak and think on a godly plane that can then be enacted in any number of relationships that we have with people. Work relationships, and school, and marriage. That's why these passages, these verses in 1 Corinthians 13 fit so well into the marriage, but it's not talking about marriage particularly. Love suffers long and is kind in verse 4. Shouldn't that describe marital love? Love does not envy. Ooh, but I see my boyfriend talking to some other girl. Love doesn't envy. Selfishness envies, but not love. So what is it I'm feeling? What's the basis of this relationship? If I can't let my boyfriend or girlfriend even have a relationship with anybody else? Is it love? Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself and is not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. Is not provoked and thinks no evil and does not rejoice in iniquity but rejoices in the truth. Does that describe your relationship with your boyfriend, girlfriend, fiance, newlywed husband or wife? Love doesn't rejoice in iniquity. Love, in all relationships for the Christian, pursues godliness. It does not rejoice in iniquity. And so 1 Corinthians 13 does very much begin to reflect marital love, though that's not why Paul wrote it. But it's the same kind of love. It's the same quality of love. And that kind of love should act in the same way. Secondly, God exemplifies the love himself that husbands and wives should exhibit toward each other. 1 John chapter 4, verses 7 and 8. This is where we see a little more deeply into the very nature of God. 1 John 4, 7 and 8, page 7. Nope, that's not right. Forget the page number. I don't have that one written down. 1 John 4:7. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. We're taking our cue about love from God. In this, the love of God was manifested toward us, that God sent His only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through Him. And this is love, verse 10, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. We're taking our cue again from God as to how we should love each other. And if it's true of the love for brethren, how much more true should we then bring the characteristics of God's love into our marriages and put it into practice there? It's not only that God loves, but God is love in verse 8. Not just that He shows love, God is the embodiment of it. So if I'm going to love, I'm going to look to God and take my cue from God as to how to love, not from culture. I shouldn't be taking my cues in how to love and how to be in a relationship from culture. But God exemplifies it. Look at Ephesians 5 very quick. We're not going to spend much time here. I'm sure we'll be dealing with this as time goes on. This is page 789 in the Pew Bible. Christ and the church serve as the backdrop, as Paul writes here concerning husbands and wives. Regarding the wives and their responsibility to submit to their husbands. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, in verse 22. Verse 24, therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Let me ask you this question. Why do we as Christians submit to the Lord? That's the pattern. As the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything. Why do we subject ourselves to the Lord? Just as mere abject slavery? Now, granted, He deserves to be followed on that basis. Just because He's the King and we're not. He's the Creator and we're the created. But is that all God is looking for? Is that all Jesus is looking for in our hearts as we submit to Him? Is not the deeper principle here we submit because we love the Lord? Does it not follow that a wife submits to her husband ultimately and in the highest level because she loves her husband? That's the ideal. It doesn't always happen that way. But I'll tell you what it does, or should do. It should make us think very, very deeply before we enter into a relationship wherein my responsibility in the relationship is to submit to somebody else. It must not be a relationship of emotion. It must be a relationship of respect. I want to submit to Him because of the qualities of Christ that He manifests. Because that's the charge given to the husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for it, verse 25. And that love and that self-sacrificial giving was to cleanse and sanctify the church. I want to repeat this. There are times in life where I'm going to have to submit as a wife because that's what God said for me to do. That's my duty and that's my responsibility. But should we not be looking for something much higher than that? That when I'm contemplating entering into a lifelong covenant, I'm searching for someone that can give me the confidence to submit to them? That I see in them a Christ-likeness that you might not see when you just go to the movies and eat out at a restaurant. What context am I going to associate in wherein I begin to see the inner workings of that person begin to come out and thus build the confidence that I can submit? I'm not a woman. Self-evident truth. But if I were, and I were interested in somebody, I'd sure be wanting to ask the question, is that somebody that I can submit my will to? Matters of judgment to? Let him be the head because I have confidence of where he's going to lead me? Rather than what kind of cologne he's going to show up in tonight? We've got to ask some deeper questions than our society is accustomed to asking when it comes to this crucial and fundamental element of entering into marriage. And that brings me to this final point. True love can be learned. It's not a feeling that merely comes and goes, and, well, I don't know where it came from, and I don't know where it went, but it was here for a while, and now it's gone. No, the kind of love that the Bible urges upon us as husbands and wives is a love that can be learned because it grows out of the will. It grows out of the nature of God, as we've already said. I take my cue from God Himself in this. It is a love that can be learned. Titus chapter 2 and verse 4, page 802 in the Pew Bible. Titus chapter 2 and verse 4, this is a charge given to older women. Notice it's given to older women in the church, not just to mothers of daughters. I think that's significant. That they admonish the young women to love their husbands and love their children. This admonishing carries the idea of teaching them. Let me ask you this question. Why should young women need to be taught to love their husbands? Primarily because we learn all the wrong things in culture. And we cannot afford just to sit back and let our sons and daughters find their own way through this maze of lust and romance and attractiveness and dating and selfishness. We can't just sit back and say, well, you know, they'll make it through in the end. This is a matter of teaching. And the charge is laid on the older women in the congregation, the women who have been down this path and seen the challenges and seen the difficulties, that know the subtleties of relationships and marriage. And it may be the young women don't have either a mother to turn to or a godly marriage in her parents to look toward. But older women are not just to be equipped, but to be active in doing this, in trying to be an influence on the young women and learning to love their husbands and love their children. This is something that we can't just sit back and let happen, but we're to be proactive in trying to reach out and develop relationships. And I'll tell you, this does not even begin, I think, with a class on the subject. It begins in a relationship that we're trying to build, older to younger, so that those younger folks not only will be comfortable seeking us out and talking, but perhaps might even be persuaded to listen. How are you doing, older sisters, in developing relationships with the younger? Or is it, whew, I'm just so glad I don't have that to deal with anymore. I don't know about these young people today. Boy, I don't even understand them anymore. I'll tell you what, we got to try to understand where young folks are coming from. I say that as a 47-year-old with teenage children and above. There's a great tendency to not just want to even understand it. But you can't afford to do that. There must be an intensive effort to build relationships, to create understanding, so that there is a flow of influence that we can teach first as parents, our children, yes. But sometimes they want to hear it from us last. And godly women can step in and say, you know what, your mother's right. And I'll tell you why she's right. This is what happened to me. This is what I had to face. This is what I had to deal with. This is real life. I'm not speaking to you from some college lectern, but I went through it. I was there and I know, and I'm trying to tell you, honey, this is what you're looking at. This is what you need to think about. This is what's going to happen if you do A or B or C. Well, as Marty said this morning, our focus in the coming year, and I think the advantage of having a theme, it's a judgment matter, but the advantage of having a theme is that it helps us focus in an intensive way. You know, sermons are forgotten sometimes by breakfast tomorrow, but we need to keep hitting over and over and over again some of these very, very important concepts so that we become conscious on a daily basis of what it is that we're facing and how we can deal with it. And as Marty said, it's we're trying to create the picture here, the image of a godly family. Not just simply trying to socially engineer something that's going to appear to be successful, however we might measure that. But to change the lives of people in marriages and in families into a more godly pattern so that the end result becomes the marriages are strengthened and the relationships with our children are stronger and we're actually guiding and leading and nurturing and developing godly children so that we too may one day see them walk in faith. I hope the thoughts we've shared tonight will help you and encourage you, and as we think about these things throughout the year, that at the end of 2006, when we have another sermon on how we did this past year, we might be able to say, in fact, my marriage is better.